This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For 20 years, author Ron Rash has been haunted by a murder that took place near his North Carolina home. The victim was a young woman. The case remains unsolved. Over time, Ron thought about the two young men reported to be the last who saw the victim alive. Who were they, and how were they involved? This became the spark for his latest novel. It's called The Risen, and it tells the story of two brothers in western North Carolina whose lives change after they meet a free-spirited young woman in the summer of 1969. Ron Rash has readings coming up next week in Asheville and Charlotte, and he is with us right now on The State of Things. Ron Rash, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
Tell us more about this real-life murder that sparked this novel.
It was a murder that really affected me because it was so close to where I lived, and I was constantly going by the place where the murder actually occurred. And it also was worrying in the sense that no one was ever found. There were two men with her the night before, but there were never any charges, no prosecution, obviously. But I knew as the months went by after that I was probably going to write something about this. And even more disconcerting was the fact that I started to dream about 6 months after this. I had a dream where I was a murderer, which was not the kind of dream you want to have.
Well, and maybe as a novelist, it is the kind of dream.
Well, I guess you could make that argument. But I would wake up and for about 4 or 5 seconds, and it was something I'd done like years before. Mm-hmm. But I kept having that dream, and now looking back on it, it was pretty clear. It was my subconscious.
How long ago was that?
This one started about 20 years ago, yeah.
All right, so there you are. You have these dreams in the immediate aftermath. You know right away that this, at some point you're going to write about this, but it's 20 years later. Had this been sort of percolating through your consciousness all that time, or did you visit periodically? How did it come to be?
I continued to have the dream over the years, but also I knew that eventually I was going to write a story about something like this. And what I thought would be an interesting setup would be that there would be two people involved in the murder, and so that the other person would spend his life wondering if the other might ever decide to confess or turn him in or something. But I still couldn't get the novel. But when I realized it was two brothers, this was about 2 years ago, I suddenly realized, okay, that's the story. The moment I knew it was brothers, because I thought that brought in an angle that made it even more interesting.
Well, tell us more about Bill and Eugene, the two brothers you just made reference to.
Yeah. Bill is the older brother, and he's the one that has, in a sense, had the golden boy. He's a very intelligent. He's done well in school. He's a good athlete, handsome. Everything has come to him. And over the years, he's become one of the best neurosurgeons in western North Carolina. The younger brother, though, who is also the narrator, Eugene, his life has fallen apart. He's lost his family. He's had some serious problems with alcohol. And so while one brother has done so wonderfully in life, the other hasn't. But when the remains of a young woman that they both knew in the summer of 1969 emerge, the younger brother, Eugene, realizes his older brother murdered her, or believes that, because the older brother had said that he had taken her to the bus station, and now he knows that's a lie.
And you've done it again, Ron Rash, as you've done successfully for so many novels in the past, made the mountains of western North Carolina a character in this book. They are vivid, the place that you write about. But you also set it in this particular time, which becomes a character, 1969, a year after the Summer of Love. And the victim in this case is a free spirit. She's wearing love beads, and she's from out of town. She's from Florida, visiting and vacation. That setting plays a key role in this, that period in American history, that time, again, set in the mountains that you write in the book, were pretty much walled off from all of that stuff, and yet, in many ways, they weren't, the times themselves. Tell us about the importance of placing the novel in that time.
It was crucial for me because one sense I had writing the novel was I wanted to give a sense of what it was like to be in any small town, probably not just in the South or the Appalachians. Because for me personally, I had this sense that so much was happening in the country, this vast change, and yet in the town where I lived, none of it seemed to be happening there. I grew up in Boiling Springs, and I can remember one day I was reading the Shelby Star, the county newspaper, and they actually had a sighting of a hippie on Highway 74. I mean, this was reported. It was like they'd found an albino wolverine or something, and they described his he had a beard and long hair, and he was in a minibus and.
Continued on page three. Yeah, continued
on
page. Well, I tell you what, maybe you can help set this up for us, and I'll ask you to read for us.
All right. Yeah, this is a scene where I hope to give a little bit of a sense of what it felt like to be in that town. When I look back on the summer of 1969, I marvel at how unconnected Silva seemed from the rest of the United States. To young people raised on the Internet, it would be unimaginable. Boy from Silva had been killed in Vietnam, another badly injured. But the war never felt within our world. Neither did the anti-war movement in Berkeley, the civil rights protests spilling into violence in Louisville, New York, or the killings of Sharon Tate and her friends in California. We saw these events on WLS in Asheville, the sole TV station we could pick up. But drained to black and white and behind glass, it was as if we peered into a telescope at some alien world. So little changed in Silva. As they had since my earliest memory, the same stores stood on Main Street, and what was inside varied little. The smallest things had their assigned place. If I went into Pike's Drugstore, candy bars were in front of the counter, comic books on a wire rack to the right. Winkler's restaurant had the same menu year after year, the same food served on the same green plates. A few things might change. A new pair of sunglasses at Dodd's General Store. Some bell-bottom jeans at Harris Clothing. But these anomalies, like the first crack in a house's foundation, went unnoticed. A willed innocent masking the world's injustice and evil. Even the town's name, a nostalgic turning away from reality, some might say. There would be some truth in such a view, but Silva's residents didn't need to look beyond their own town to know injustice and evil. As Sheriff Loudermilk noted, small towns have a way of giving up their secrets.
Author Ron Rash reading from his new novel, The Risen. It's going to read next Tuesday at Park Road Books in Charlotte, and then Wednesday at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. I wonder how you, as a writer, sort of, because you talk about this innocence, but there's going to be a lot of things crashing in. First of all, there's the bubbling evil within all of us in any town. And then the way in which the world crashes in on a small town like that, otherwise isolated. How do you recapture that? If you felt that innocence at all yourself, mm-hmm. if you were innocent in that time, do you have to go and tap into that as you reconstruct this, as you construct this story?
I did, and one thing I wanted to attempt in the book was to have almost everything that, when we think of the 60s, the light, the optimism, and then the darker parts of it, I wanted it all to come together in this Appalachian community, or with these two boys, in a single summer. And I thought that would be, to me, an interesting concept, because Ligia, the young woman who comes from Florida, who's lived in a commune for a few months, run away, when she comes in, she brings so much of that, the idea of free love and the idea of the music and the exuberance, but also we start to see a darker impulse, which, in a sense, particularly in 1969, we really saw that turn with right. the Mansons, and also what happened at Altamont Speedway with the right. the concert, where it ended up with someone being killed.
Right. So all of that kind of from the outside, the kind of objective way in which the dream of this sort of free love was already being proved a bit of a lie. And then there are the local structures, and I want to ask you about this decision. You've got two brothers, and you talked about the importance of that decision, making them brothers, but their father is lost. They're living with their mother and their grandfather, a very stern guy who is very controlling. What was behind that decision to have them grow up fatherless with a stern grandfather?
I thought it would complicate the book and also their behavior, because one aspect of the book that I really worked hard on, I wanted the reader to be a little bit unsure of how sympathetic or not sympathetic the reader would be toward these characters. And I think by bringing in this really, for me, frightening grandfather, and I thought that would be kind of interesting, you know, because usually we think of grandfathers being quite the opposite, that it would complicate the decisions they made later. And something I'd always thought of growing up in a small town, my doctors were great there, but it always, I can remember even as a teenager thinking, this man knows everything about everyone, mm-hmm. all the secrets in the town. And I thought, what if you had a doctor who was malevolent and he had this power because he knows everyone's story and their weaknesses and their sins, all those things.
Well, it's fascinating too, because if you think going back to the 60s, the freedom that, you know, sort of everybody longed for was this freedom from these repressive structures like a controlling grandfather. And of course, the way it went wrong is the way it goes wrong all the time. It's, you sort of imagine yourself free, and then you don't know what that means when you get there, and a lot of bad things happen. And the way in which the outside world, you can't keep the outside world out. I think it's fascinating stuff the way you put all of it together. The idea that you had to make a choice now between these two brothers, and I also think the way, I think you've spoken about the way Dostoevsky's writing influenced perhaps all your writing, but particularly this book, the way the imagination, the sense of guilt plays a part in this novel. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Dostoevsky has always been my favorite writer. I first read him when I was 15, and as I've told people in the past, when I read Crime and Punishment, before that, I'd always entered books. That was the first book to enter me. Mm-hmm. That book had such a power that I still marvel that splotches of ink on a page could have that kind of effect on me. But because I love Dostoevsky so much, I wanted this book to, I hope, evoke something of what the kind of questions that he would bring up, because he was always so much about the big questions. And in this novel, I actually borrowed the epigraph is from the brothers Karamazov, and it is, "And then the punishment began." And that's said by a character who has actually gotten away with murder, and he's lived years knowing that, in a sense, at least by the law, he will never be punished. But to him, that's a worse punishment. And so that certainly plays out in this novel, because 46 years after Lygia has been murdered, the younger brother, Eugene, will confront Bill about this murder. And so what the reader starts to find out is how both these men have lived their lives since that summer.
What I find fascinating about your writing is how, on the surface, it is so realistic and palpable. You bring me to the place, you bring me to the time, and yet in that way that Dostoevsky does, it's a kind of magical realism. You take me deep into the imagination, which is real, but the way it superimposes images over what's objective out there, is powerful, probably what bowled you over about Crime and Punishment. Is that something you reach for? Is that something you consciously try to achieve, these kinds of layers of subjective vision over the objective truth? Or are you just lucky, Ron? Are you just lucky?
Well, I work hard at it. No book comes easy for me. But yeah, and I, for me, what I hope is that readers will be reading along and sometimes maybe just think, well, this is a kind of a superficial coming-of-age story, and almost suddenly realize, whoa, there's a lot more going on in this book. And that's my hope, that there's a depth to it, there are layers to it. One thing I kind of played off of was a mythology, particularly with the name Lygia. That means Queen of the Mermaids. And Lygia is constantly connected to water. And I hope that kind of added, and with the two brothers, the kind of conflict almost going back to Cain and Abel. So I hope that there might be a level there that might be interesting.
Work for me, Ron. Whenever if you take me into the water, I'm immediately in the subconscious, and all those kind of murky dreams bubble up. If I may extend the metaphor beyond its use for you. Thank you. Hey, would you read for us again? Bail me out of this?
Yeah. Okay. One of the best things about doing this book was I got to go back through all my LPs. I had to wipe the dust off of them to remember what I'd bought. But that was one of the wonders was, as you know, and I remember this very vividly when I was 16, that at night I would listen to the radio stations and, you know, from very far away, Fort Wayne, Chicago, and it was almost like messages that were kind of washing up in a bottle to me about, you know, all this that was going on. So this is where I got to remember that. That July, I bought an AM-FM radio at Pike's Drugstore. Before, I'd spent the last hour awake reading or attempting poems and stories in a Blue Horse notebook. But now I spent much of the time with a finger and thumb on the dial, searching for stations playing the music Ligeia told me about. The signals drifted in and out between gulfs of static. After a while, I knew where they'd be if they did break through. I'd imagine the pulsing antennas of Fort Wayne and Chicago, New Orleans and Kansas City. Even on the best stations like WLS in Chicago or WKDA in Nashville, there would be top 40 fluff. But then I'd hear something by the Doors or Jefferson Airplane or Big Brother and the Holding Company, even an occasional single by the Dead or Jethro Tull. I learned to recognize bands by voices, Morrison or Joplin, or by guitar, Clapton or Hendrix. It was here I first heard the Grateful Dead's China Cat Sunflower, and Quicksilver Messenger Service's Light Your Windows, and the Steve Miller Band's Children of the Future. But also darker tunes, including the darkest of them all, The Doors' The End, with its premonition of what would soon come about in Brentwood and Altamont. Reflecting now on that summer, I realized The Doors were the group I should have listened to most intently.
Ron Rash, reading from his new novel, The Risen. He's going to read Tuesday at Park Road Books in Charlotte, and then Wednesday he'll be at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. Did this story come together for you? Did you know how it was going to end when you started it?
I never know. That's one thing that is always a little frightening, that I never have a complete idea of where the story's going. I knew how it definitely would start, but how it would end, I really did not know until I got deep into the book, you know, a year later. And so, yeah, I never know where they're going, and sometimes it seems the characters have more control than I do. I sometimes tell people that even if you don't believe humans have free will, you got to believe your characters do.
How about those dreams? Have they stopped? Have they changed? Do you think about the original murder differently now that you've written the book?
I have never, once I started the book, that dream has never come back. Right. Of course, now it's going to come tonight, probably, because I say that. But that was, that just proved to me how powerful the subconscious was, because it was prodding me. It was telling me I was going to write about this. And so I think finally, I hope I've gotten that part of my psyche
well,
satisfied.
All right, so what are your latest dreams, Ron? I want to know what you're working on next.
Only happy things.
No, Ron, don't.
People know better than that.
Be the end of your career, buddy.
Yeah. Well, I am actually writing. Trying to write a few humorous stories, including one kind of autobiographical about my ninth grade when I managed to make, I think, the lowest grade in the my high school's history in French. So
well done. We will have you back for that, mon ami. Okay. That means my friend in French, in case you didn't. Ron Rash, new novel called The Risen, Tuesday at Park Road Books in Charlotte, then Malaprop's in Asheville. Ron, always a pleasure. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, NPR's Nina Totenberg joins us, tells us about her time covering the Supreme Court. You're not going to want to miss it.